Welcome back to the 2 a.m. Book Review Club, where we stay up late talking about books or talk about books that made us stay up late. This week, we are wrapping up our Mystery Marathon March mini-series, where we are reading as many mystery books as we can during the month of March. I am also hosting a Mystery Marathon March reading challenge over on the StoryGraph link in the description. Please note that you will need to create a StoryGraph account if you don't already have an existing account in order to participate in this reading challenge. Also, given the title of the reading challenge, Mystery Marathon March, the reading challenge will close on March 31st. So if you are interested in participating, then you will need to join before March 31st. For our final week of Mystery Marathon March, I read 3 mystery books, which brings my total number of mystery books I read in March up to 11, which is definitely a lot of mystery books, even for a seasoned mystery aficionado like me. In this mini-series, I've had a bit of a mixed track record when it comes to reading mystery books. I fully, completely, actually enjoyed. And that is kind of true for this week's mystery books as well. But mixed feelings for me as a reader means that there is plenty for me to discuss as a reviewer. So let's get into it. The first mystery book I want to talk about this week is The Marlowe Murder Club by Robert Thorogood. I actually switched things up a bit with The Marlowe Murder Club because I listened to the audiobook, which I have never done for a mystery book before, mainly because when I read mystery books, it tends to involve a lot of processing and putting things together in my head. And I guess I always thought it might be more difficult to do that when I have less control over my reading experience. The charm of audiobooks is that it feels like someone is reading you a bedtime story, pulling you inexorably into the narrative. But the trade-off is that I'm being pulled along at someone else's pace rather than being able to set my own. But I'm nothing if not adventurous when it comes to expanding my reading horizons. So I chose The Marlowe Murder Club as my very first mystery audiobook experience, and I actually really enjoyed it. I think the narrator did a great job. I can really tell how much effort went into the narrator's performance, and listening to the audiobook really enhanced what would otherwise have been kind of a mediocre reading experience. The Marlowe Murder Club follows Judith Potts, an older woman who lives by herself in this big, fancy house that she inherited from her late aunt. She likes setting crosswords, having an evening glass or two or three of whiskey, and spending time on the river that her house overlooks. She's a bit lonely living by herself, but she values her independence, and for the most part, she leads a quiet, comfortable existence. Until one evening when she's swimming in the river and happens to overhear a gunshot coming from the direction of her neighbor's house. Her neighbor obviously turns up dead, but the police refuse to believe that he was murdered because this is the quaint English town of Marlowe, and things like murder just don't happen here. So now, of course, it's up to Judith and the friends she makes along the way to solve the puzzle of who in Marlowe could possibly be a killer. From the description I've given you, you can obviously decipher that this is a cozy mystery featuring an older protagonist in the same vein as the Thursday Murder Club, which I feel like really set off this trend of older protagonists in the mystery genre. And I'm really excited to read the Thursday Murder Club whenever my hold finally comes through, because I have heard so many great things about it. And with any cozy mystery, one of the most important aspects the author needs to get right is that cozy atmosphere of a small town where, sure, a murder or two or three or however long the series is might occur, but overall, it's a friendly, peaceful place where friendly, peaceful people live. And I do have to give the Marlowe Murder Club the credit it deserves in this department, because the little village of Marlowe definitely exudes a distinctly British flavor of coziness, at least to my non-British sensibilities. The other thing a cozy mystery needs to get right is, of course, the mystery. And again, I do want to give credit where credit is due, because with all of the focus that the book puts on Judith's love of puzzles and how good she is at creating and solving puzzles, there is going to be an expectation on the part of the reader that the author will provide this particular protagonist with a suitably clever and tricky and satisfying mystery. And like I said, credit where credit is due, because this is a mystery with so many moving parts and so many people involved that it is genuinely confusing to see through everything that is going on and figure out the exact nature of what happened and why, especially since the misdirection is so well executed. I don't think I've seen a similar plot twist before, and I did genuinely think that, like a good puzzle, it was satisfying to put all of the pieces of this mystery together. So, if I think the Marlowe Murder Club is suitably cozy, and if I also think the mystery is clever, then why did I call this cozy mystery kind of a mediocre reading experience? Obviously, this is just my personal opinion, my personal reading experience. But for me, the mediocrity really comes down to two issues. One, the mystery, and two, the characters. Now, I know that I literally just said that I thought the mystery was a clever and satisfying puzzle, and it was, but at the same time, it's not really the kind of mystery I tend to enjoy. My favorite kind of mystery is the psychological mystery, where the solution completely upends the emotional status quo that was established at the beginning of the story. In other words, I just really enjoy the classic whodunit with the small group of suspects who all have a motive for murder. But the Marlowe Murder Club isn't that kind of mystery because from the very beginning, there isn't really much doubt as to who is committing these murders. It's more a question of how are they getting away with it. Intellectually, it is a fun puzzle to solve, but emotionally, it's just kind of like, well, that's that, I guess. If you like police procedurals, if you like howdunits, then this mystery is definitely up your alley. But while it's nice to switch things up in my mystery reading habits, this kind of mystery will ultimately never really resonate with me as a reader. But honestly, I don't think my opinions about the type of mystery featured in this book would have been as big of a deal if I hadn't been so annoyed by the characters in this book, The Marlowe Murder Club. If I hadn't been listening to the audiobook and enjoying the narrator's performance so much, I honestly think I might have DNF'd it purely based on the characters alone. That is how annoying I found them to be. Quirky characters and quirky protagonists in particular are hard to pull off in a way that's appealing to your readers because quirky characters tend to have mannerisms and speech patterns that can become grating when they're repeated often enough. We've all read that romance novel where the so-called quirky protagonist repeats some variation of, "Oh, I'm not like the other girls. Isn't that special and unique?" every other paragraph. Judith Potts, the protagonist of The Marlowe Murder Club, is not a 20-something with outlandish fashion sense who refuses to listen to anything as mainstream as Taylor Swift, but she does suffer from a similar issue of what I would call aggressive typecasting. When you're reading the book, at some point you can't help being like, okay, we get it. It's so unique and so special that she's an older woman who actually has a personality that is not smiling old grandmother, and we get that she's happy being independent, and we get that it's absolutely hilarious that she lives in this big fancy house, but she's not posh at all. Oh. And isn't being an alcoholic just a quirky personality trait and not at all concerning for an older woman living by herself in a house that is the opposite of accessible? It's not that I necessarily dislike a feisty older woman as a protagonist, because that's not true. I've definitely read books with feisty older women who were a lot of fun to read about. For example, T. Kingfisher's Nettle and Bone features an older woman as a major side character who definitely qualifies as feisty and maybe even quirky, and I really enjoyed spending time with her. But T. Kingfisher is also an author who's aware of a little something called nuance and isn't trying to shove the same character traits down her readers' throats every other sentence. And while I understand that high fantasy is a genre with a completely different tone and style than a cozy mystery, and I understand that a cozy mystery wants to keep things lighthearted and humorous, I also just don't find Judith's brand of forced quirkiness as humorous as the author wants me to. But the thing about Judith is that she isn't just annoying, she's also got a bad case of too stupid to survive a mystery book without heavy plot armor. Here's a quick pop quiz. If you suspect someone is a murderer, do you A, go to that person's office and accuse them of murder, or B, do literally anything else? Well, if you're Judith Potts, you go with option A, because apparently honesty is always the best policy, which is not a motto of any detective I've ever read about before, because most detectives would like to survive the mystery that they're trying to solve. But as much as I found Judith to be annoying and kind of stupid, she's not the only character I found to be, let's say, poorly portrayed. The award for most poorly portrayed character in the Marlowe Murder Club has to go to Bex Starling, the local vicar's wife who Judith meets and befriends in the course of her so-called investigation. I absolutely hate how the narrative treats Bex, who is basically the most stereotypically image and body obsessed perfect mother and housewife to ever exist. I want to clarify that I don't have an issue with the actual character of Bex, who really struggles to find her independence and her identity outside of being a wife and mother. She's a character that I think a lot of women can probably relate to, a character who is flawed and relatable and definitely a person you've met before. What I do have an issue with, however, is the way that the narrative consistently treats Bex. Every time she's on page, at every possible turn, the narrative takes any opportunity to make fun of Bex in what I feel is frankly an almost vicious way. Literally, there is nothing that Bex can do without the narrative itself making it seem stupid and silly and wrong. Oh, Bex likes to keep her house neat? That's stupid and silly and wrong. Unlike being so messy that you've literally got dirty dishes piled up everywhere, which is apparently charming and quirky. This must be an opinion held by someone who has never lived in a place with thriving insect populations, because I can assure you that there is nothing charming or quirky about an ant or cockroach or fruit fly infestation. Oh, Bex offers her guests almond milk? That's stupid and silly and wrong, because obviously, regular milk is always better, and screw you, I guess, lactose intolerant people. It's not just the narrative either, because Judith and their other friend, Susie, are both so mean to Bex as well. Apparently, by the end of the book, they're all friends, but honestly, Bex only considers these people her friends because she has got no backbone and she doesn't care that all they do is walk all over her boundaries and treat her like she's the silly woman that the narrative wants us to think she is. And I know I seem a little harsh here, but my personal tipping point was where the narrative actively makes fun of Bex having a dust allergy. Personally, I also have a really bad dust allergy, and I know it sounds funny, even harmless, but it's really not. An allergy is an allergy is an allergy, and no matter how silly it sounds, under the right, or rather wrong, circumstances, even a dust allergy can be deadly. Anyone who has an unusual or obscure allergy probably understands how it feels to have your allergy belittled, but having an allergy to something as common as dust is a miserable experience that I don't wish on anyone else. And it's just not funny to have someone who clearly doesn't understand this particular medical issue make fun of it. So there we go. I like the coziness. I mostly like the mystery, but the characters in particular grated on me so badly that there is no way I would have made it through this book if I hadn't been listening to the audiobook. However, if you are still interested in reading The Marlowe Murder Club, I would highly recommend the audiobook because the performance is absolutely perfect for this story. If you're looking for a cozy British puzzle-based murder mystery to listen to as you do other things like, I don't know, crosswords would probably be appropriate, then The Marlowe Murder Club could be a good choice, but personally, I wouldn't recommend it. So that is mystery number one, and now let's move on to mystery number two. We Were Liars by E. Lockhart, which, as the author herself notes, has elicited a lot of strong feelings since its publication in 2014. And after finishing the book, I can definitely see why. We Were Liars features the Sinclair family, a rich, beautiful blonde family who gather every summer at Martha's Vineyard. Our protagonist is Cadence, nicknamed Katie, like the protagonist in Mean Girls, who is part of the Liars, a group of young Sinclairs and their token outsider friend who enjoy their summers together but are becoming increasingly aware of the darkness that lies beneath the golden Sinclair facade. The story opens with Katie returning to the island after an accident that happened two summers ago and which involved a traumatic brain injury that has left Katie unable to remember what exactly happened leading up to her accident, and even the exact nature of what led to her accident. This summer, Katie is determined to figure out what happened and why it has so fundamentally changed the Sinclair family dynamics. My number one comparison for We Were Liars would not be a book at all, but actually the TV show Succession. This is basically a YA version of Succession. And when I make this comparison, I'm thinking in particular about the Sinclair family dynamics and how money and property and questions of who inherits what and who deserves to have what turn this family into a toxic, backbiting, vicious mess. Here's an excerpt that illustrates the point I'm trying to make here. "We're not lonely," Mummy told Granddad. "We adore Windermere, don't we, Katie?" Granddad beamed at me. "You okay there, Cadence?" I knew what I was supposed to say. "I'm more than okay there. I'm fantastic. I love Windermere because you built it specially for Mummy. I want to raise my own children there and my children's children." "You are so excellent, Granddad. You are the patriarch, and I revere you. I am so glad I am a Sinclair. This is the best family in America." Not in those words, but I was meant to help Mummy keep the house by telling my grandfather that he was the big man, that he was the cause of all our happiness, and by reminding him that I was the future of the family. The all-American Sinclairs would perpetuate ourselves, tall and white and beautiful and rich, if only he let me and Mummy stay in Windermere. I was supposed to make Granddad feel in control when his world was spinning because Gran had died. I was to beg him by praising him, never acknowledging the aggression behind his question. My mother and her sisters were dependent on Granddad and his money. They had the best educations, 1,000 chances, 1,000 connections, and still they'd ended up unable to support themselves. None of them did anything useful in the world. Nothing necessary. Nothing brave. They were still little girls, trying to get in good with Daddy. He was their bread and butter, their cream and honey, too. I mean, what is this scene if not Logan Roy stringing his children along, using his wealth and power to torture them to the point of desperation? We Were Liars is kind of like if there was a spinoff of the last season of Succession featuring the Roy grandchildren. And I think that whether or not you will enjoy this book, We Were Liars, largely comes down to two factors. Factor number one is the themes. We Were Liars, like Succession, grapples with themes of generational wealth, the inequity it produces, what, if anything, the heirs to that wealth can or should do about that inequity, and how prejudice, especially racial prejudice, feeds into and is in turn fed by that intergenerational wealth. The inertia of wealth and privilege, the cruelty and dysfunction inherent in extremely wealthy families when the inheritance of that wealth is at stake. Do you like reading about these themes? And maybe even more subjectively, do you like the specific treatment of those themes that happens in this book? For example, here's an excerpt where Katie is having a realization about who her grandfather really is. One of his mottos, "Don't take no for an answer." It had always seemed a heroic way to live. He would say it when advising us to pursue our ambitions, when encouraging Johnny to try training for a marathon, or when I failed to win the reading prize in 7th grade. It was something he said when talking about his business strategies and how he got Gran to marry him. I asked her 4 times before she said yes, he'd always say, retelling one of his favorite Sinclair family legends. I wore her down. She said yes to shut me up. Now, at the breakfast table, watching him eat my toast, "Don't take no for an answer," seemed like the attitude of a privileged guy who didn't care who got hurt, so long as his wife had the cute statues she wanted to display in her summer houses. I mean, this is very clearly a discussion of privilege and power that is occurring at a YA level, which makes complete sense in the context of this being a YA book, but it's certainly not going to appeal to everyone. The other factor, I think, is definitive when it comes to whether or not a particular person will enjoy reading We Were Liars is the writing style. I think We Were Liars is definitely a book where if you remember nothing else, you will definitely remember the writing style because it's so distinctive. For example, there are several places in the book where the author wants to indicate that this is an emotional turning point, an emotional highlight. And so what she does is insert a whole bunch of line breaks so that the passage reads kind of like pseudo-poetry, except that it's not actually poetry. Let me give you an example, and as I'm reading this excerpt to you, I will indicate every time that there's a line break. "I had come here to this island from a house of tears and falsehood," line break, "and I saw Gat," line break, "and I saw that rose in his hand," line break, "and in that one moment with the sunlight from the window shining in on him," line break, "the apples on the kitchen counter," line break, "the smell of wood and ocean in the air," line break, "I did call it love." Is this pretentious? Yes. But will it work for some people? Also yes. There are also places in the book where the themes, the messaging, is wrapped up in the form of fairy tales because Katie likes to read, and these fairy tales are part of her attempts to put into context the way things are now as opposed to the way they were before, and how she can use the differences in now versus before to understand what exactly happened. Here's an excerpt where Katie is riffing on Beauty and the Beast. "We all know that Beauty grows to love the Beast. She grows to love him, despite what her family might think, for his charm and education, his knowledge of art, and his sensitive heart. Indeed, he is a human and always was. He never was a wild boar / jackal at all. It was only a hideous illusion. Trouble is, it's awfully hard to convince her father of that. Her father sees the jaws and the snout. He hears the hideous growl whenever Beauty brings her new husband home for a visit. It doesn't matter how civilized and erudite the husband is. It doesn't matter how kind. The father sees a jungle animal, and his repugnance will never leave him." Again, this is unexpected, and again, a little pretentious, and it's a literary device that is really going to work for and resonate with certain types of readers while completely alienating others. I mean, it definitely wasn't what I was expecting when I picked up a YA mystery, and honestly, I could say that for just about every aspect of We Were Liars. It's creative and different and definitely not what I was expecting. Overall, I did enjoy this book, We Were Liars, because the writing and the themes worked for me as the type of reader that I am. If you've ever read the book, you're probably wondering how I felt about the big plot twist, And I do have to admit that that was one of the aspects of the book that did let me down a bit. I know it's supposed to be shocking, but believe it or not, this is a plot twist that I have read before in other mysteries and thrillers. And I was just kind of like, ugh, not this again. However, I didn't mention it specifically as a deal breaker for whether or not you'll love the book or hate it, mostly because if you like the book up to the plot twist, I feel like you're just kind of along for the ride at that point. It's a logical culmination of everything that the book is trying to say up to that point. And if you aren't enjoying the book up to the plot twist, then I feel like the plot twist will just solidify your negative opinion. Speaking of things I didn't really like, I did feel like the pacing could have been tighter. The book is short enough that it doesn't really matter because you finish it in no time anyway, and the tiny chapters do propel you through the book really quickly, so it's not really an issue, but I just didn't really feel the tension I was expecting to feel from this particular type of story. But like I've already said, for such a divisive book, I do personally come down on the side of people who did enjoy We Were Liars, but I definitely agree with the general consensus that this is not a book for everyone, and I don't really feel like I can widely recommend it. And then finally, mystery book number three was Black Rabbit Hall by Eve Chase, which was actually the mystery I read first this week, but I'm discussing it last in this episode because it is an older title from 2016 that I feel like not many people have heard of before. Black Rabbit Hall is a dual timeline novel that follows Amber, a member of the close-knit Alton family, who is coming of age in the late 1960s, and Lorna, a young woman searching for answers to her mysterious past 3 decades later. These two characters are connected, of course, via the titular Black Rabbit Hall, a crumbling mansion in Cornwall, England, that has been in the Alton family for generations. Lorna stumbles on Black Rabbit Hall while she's searching for a wedding venue and ends up being sucked into the tragic mystery of what exactly happened at Black Rabbit Hall 3 decades earlier and how it connects to her. Black Rabbit Hall is a vaguely gothic, intergenerational family drama featuring a suitably atmospheric old mansion and deep, dark secrets that really aren't as deep and dark as the book wants you to think they are. I love gothic stories, I love vaguely gothic stories, and I love intergenerational family dramas, which means that this is not the first time I've read a book like Black Rabbit Hall. Some similar books I've read recently are Starling House by Alex E. Harrow, and also We Have Always Lived in the Castle by Shirley Jackson, and maybe even The Book of Cold Cases by Simone St. James. On the surface, these are three very different books, but like Black Rabbit Hall, they all feature family drama, dark secrets, and big houses that loom large over the events of the story. Unlike Black Rabbit Hall, however, these three books are all innovative, cleverly crafted, and will probably stay with me for a long time. This isn't to say that Black Rabbit Hall doesn't have its strengths, because it definitely does. Black Rabbit Hall isn't the most memorable, gothic-esque mansion I've ever read about, but it is suitably atmospheric and evocative and slightly sinister. I also really enjoyed the chapters focused on the Alton family because the dynamic between the Alton siblings is so refreshingly realistic, especially since at the beginning of the book, the Altons are this close-knit, very happy family. I've read a lot of depictions of unhappy families and unhappy siblings over the years, but you don't often read about happy families, probably because Tolstoy once said that they're boring to read about. And I did really enjoy that aspect of this book. Here's an excerpt describing the Alton family's happiness that I really liked. "You can't disguise happiness in children, Lorna knows from experience. Those who have it own it. They gleam and glow. And it hangs around this group of children like a golden aura in every photo, yelping into the sea, hanging upside down from the branches by their knees, eating sandwiches on a windy beach, huddled, grinning and frozen beneath tents of towels." I also like how the dynamic between the children and their father changes after tragedy strikes. The way that this family drifts apart and hurts each other even when they don't mean to. For example, here's Amber commenting on how her father is failing to connect with her twin brother, Toby. "Worse, Daddy has been inviting Lucian into the library to listen to jazz. Toby's never been invited into the library to listen to jazz. It really makes me mad that Daddy is making an effort to get to know Lucian, but he never tries to get to know Toby. Maybe he's scared of what he'll find. Maybe he thinks he knows Toby already. Well, he doesn't. Daddy doesn't know Toby any more than he knows me now. He has no idea that we are both different people from who we were even at the start of the holidays, that everything has changed." I think that adults must get sort of worn away over time, like rocks out at sea, but remain who they are, just slower and grayer, with those funny vertical wrinkles in front of their ears. But the young are a different shape from 1 week to the next. To know us is to run alongside us, like someone trying to shout through the window of a moving train. By the way, I also appreciate that given that we have two first-person narrators in this story, those narrators have distinct enough voices that I'm not constantly confused about whose head I'm in, which is not something I can say about a lot of dual timeline stories. But while there are things I appreciate about this book, Black Rabbit Hall, it was ultimately kind of a forgettable reading experience for three main reasons. The first reason, and probably the most important, is that a lot of the plot hinges around this evil stepmother character who is cartoonishly evil while also managing to be incredibly bland because we don't know who she is outside of, you know, being the evil character that literally everyone hates. I dislike two-dimensional characters in general, and I especially dislike these types of characters in family drama stories because it's just not very interesting to read about. The second reason is that while I was very engaged with the book for the first half or maybe three quarters, towards the end, I kind of lost interest, which is disappointing because that's where all of the big reveals are happening. Not only are the reveals underwhelming, but the story loses all of the emotional immediacy that I was really enjoying, and instead devolves into melodramatic chaos that should at least be fun, but instead ends up being kind of boring for some reason. The third and final reason Black Rabbit Hall is forgettable is that it doesn't really have anything to say except maybe that stepmothers are just as evil as the fairy tales would have you believe. And I do feel like there is a missed opportunity here because early on in the book, we seem to be setting up a conversation about class and privilege and landowning. Here's Amber's mother talking to her about Black Rabbit Hall. "Never forget how privileged we are still to have Black Rabbit Hall. So many of Daddy's friends have had to demolish their country houses and sell off the land or open their homes to the public. Awful things like that. We must never take it for granted." And then in Lorna's timeline, this idea gets brought up again when she and her fiancé John visit Black Rabbit Hall and talk to a maid named Dill. "This floor is not used anymore," Dill says, reaching over and closing the door as if she cannot bear to see its contents. "Mrs. Alton has no need for so many rooms." "Does anyone?" John asks, the seriousness of the question lightened by his smile. Lorna knows all too well what he's thinking. "So many people without homes at all, and it's true that too many of her pupils live in hostels or B&Bs, one family to a room, and this vast house is populated by just one old lady and her housekeeper." Rationally, politically, she agrees with him. Secretly, she's rather pleased that houses like Black Rabbit Hall still exist. You would think it's fairly obvious that all of this is going somewhere interesting, but actually, it doesn't go anywhere at all. And that's true for all of the themes that this book brings up and then refuses to explore. Also, for any editors at Penguin Random House who might happen to be listening, there's a typo in chapter 10 where it says "he eyes grow" instead of "his eyes grow." You know, right after the bit where Lorna's dad goes on a weird misogynistic rant about how men think with their brains gray matter and women think with their brains white matter, because I'm sure that's completely scientifically accurate. So that is Black Rabbit Hall, a book that has a lot of elements I tend to enjoy, but which just didn't manage to put those pieces together in a way that was new or original or even particularly interesting. If you are thinking about picking up Black Rabbit Hall, I would honestly recommend any of the other three books that I pulled out as comp titles. And those are all of the mystery books I read for the final week of Mystery Marathon March. This is the last episode of our Mystery Marathon March mini-series, but if you'd like to participate in the official Mystery Marathon March reading challenge, then the link is in the description and the challenge will be active until March 31st. Please note that the challenge is being hosted on the Storygraph, so you will need to create a Storygraph account in order to join said challenge. And that's going to be everything for this episode. This has been the 2AM Book Review Club. Thanks so much for joining me, and thanks so much to everyone who participated in the official Mystery Marathon March Reading Challenge. I will be back next week at 2AM, and until then, I hope you have a great week, and happy book travels!